So it's great to be back in the damp and chilly UK after a month in France. The background noise to my audio, instead of it being Yvette and Claudine screaming at each other in the square outside our house in France, we're back to Rat Run Friday.
Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you. I don't know if I told you the story, actually. One of the days we were recording when I was in France, so Yvette is this sort of the village matriarch. She's one of these old ladies who has lived in the village almost forever, and she's 81 now and still climbing ladders and chopping logs and stuff. And she sort of walks around dressed in with her wellies and a headscarf and an apron. And her sister-in-law, Claudine, lives next door to her. And one day they were in the yard screaming at each other, having a blazing round. And Yvette was waving a sickle to Claudine. So I thought, this is going to end in tears.
Oh, blimey. Okay, so welcome to another Hidden Wiltshire podcast, where we talk about things in Wiltshire that are not so well known and relatively hidden. My name is Glyn Coy. I am the person behind Hidden Wiltshire. And in this podcast, I have my usual podcasting partner.
Paul Timlett. Not Monsieur Paul Timlett this week, but Mr. Paul Timlett.
There's a bit of a pause then. You almost forgot your name.
I did. At my age, is not unusual. I have forgotten my age at times, so...
I'm always doing that. Actually, this is a funny year for me, because my last birthday, I turned 49, so I'm kind of mulling over, should I remain 49 for a few years, or embrace the coming 50?
Well, you are, of course, in your 50th year, so...
Exactly. But anyway, we don't talk about that because it's too sensitive.
Well, so, yeah, try being my age. I'm staring down the barrel of pensionable age fairly soon.
Yeah.
Moving swiftly on.
So what have you been up to in the last 2 weeks? I mean, it's interesting because we did get together, didn't we, a couple of days ago, because we've kind of reached the end of the road almost on the next Hidden Wiltshire book.
Well, that sounds like it's about to fall apart.
Hopefully it'll come together.
It will.
We've kind of got to the end of the editing process, almost. We've just got to get a test copy of the book, and then we'll check it over and make sure it's okay before we click the green light and get it out into the wider world in early December.
And of course, we got a bit of feedback from our chum Steve Dixon, who does the music, who, apart from being a great musician, a terrific photographer, is a graphic designer by trade. So he gave it the once over and gave us a couple of tips on how to make it look a bit better.
So it might look half professional by the time it gets back from the printers.
It's getting becoming a worrying trend.
You're giving the impression that we might be winging all of this stuff.
We wing everything, Glyn. You know that.
We're not professional. Actually, one interesting thing. When we were coming out, because we met at Haywood House, just by Haywood, actually, near Westbury. And as we were coming out of the main house, we looked up on the hill in the distance because we could see Branton Camp and the Long Barrow, and we could also see Pickett Hill. And we noticed some rather large orange thing on the hill. What we thought was orange, and we suddenly realised it was every year they put up a giant poppy on the hill, but it didn't look red to us; it looked orange from where we were.
Yeah, and as you know, I sort of after we finished and I drove off, I drove up there I decided to follow the Imber perimeter path, drive along it all the way around to get me south of. West Lavington, because they were setting up roadworks there. So I sort of passed it by, and it's definitely orange, but that poppy. But I'm just desperately looking for his name now. A guy one of the members of the Facebook group. Oh, this is terrible. I've forgotten his name. I'm terribly sorry. But he posted a picture of it and a bit of video footage. I'm nearly at his name. Oh, here we are.
Andrew
Ratnett. Thank you, Andrew.
Yes.
He posted a photograph of it, and it didn't look orange. It looked pink. So, yeah. Infinite shades of pink.
Yeah, but if you're out and about, try and find it, because it is quite an impressive sight. Might go up there and fly the drone, who knows. But yeah, we saw that. But what else have you been up to over the last 2 weeks?
Well, what else have I been up to? Fun and games at Parsonage Down yesterday. So it was my first sort of my first week back. It wasn't. I was there last week, because people might know I volunteer at Parsonage Down, the Natural England Nature Reserve, just outside Shrewton, do that once a week. So I went last week, was my first week back, but yesterday we were up there, and you never know what you're going to be faced with when we go. We don't know what we're going to be doing. And we sort of arrive, and Ben, who's the farm manager up there, he'll sort of surprise us with tasks of the day. So we sort of started off spreading some bedding for the cattle, which we have different herds of English Longhorn up there, and one lot. So in the farming world, they're called stores. So these are steers and heifers that will be sold, so they won't be kept in the herd to propagate the herd. They're sold on, and so of course they need to gain weight, and we need to fatten them up. And the being chalk grassland is pretty poor quality. So we to get the stores up to weight before they're sold on next year, we bring them in to the cattle sheds over winter, and feed them some hay, and the hay is cut from the down, but also bought in. So we put in a load of bedding for the stores. But after that, we were asked to go and do some mend some fences. On our way down there, they were trying to move a ram from one field through the farmyard to another, and this ram has been in with one of the Longhorn bulls, and they become quite good friends, and they keep each other company, a bit like horses and donkeys. People who keep horses quite often have a donkey in with it, or Shetland pony. So Sirloin the Bull, whose future was probably encapsulated by his name there, a name like Sirloin, he's not going to be long for this world, but Sirloin and this ram were being moved through the farmyard, and we separated Sirloin, put him in a barn, and the ram, we wanted to sort of separate him off into a field and put him in with some of the other rams before being put in with the sheep. And I didn't know that sheep or rams could run so quickly. So there was this really comical scene. There were seven of us chasing this bloody ram around a field, and then some idiot had left the bottom gate of the field open. So of course, and 200-300 meters away, this ram had spied this gate and was off. So six of us plus somebody else in a Land Rover chasing this bloody ram around. It took us about 3/4 of an hour to catch him and put him in with his mates, who then turned on him and beat him up. So there's a lot of pushing and shoving going on as they were trying to assert their manhood.
It sounds like something from an episode of Clarkson's Farm. Have you ever seen that?
I haven't, but I've heard about it, and I can imagine. It reminded me of a scene from Benny Hill or something. And I was just standing, and you could see the scene making for the gate at the bottom of the field. Oh no, we know exactly where he's going.
And you could just imagine everyone thinking, which prat left that gate open?
Exactly. But once we sort of tucked him away in his field, we sort of turned to the issue of mending the fence. And God, you got to wonder what's happening with the weather. We started off, it was freezing cold. There was a frost. Actually, no, there wasn't a frost yesterday morning. There was this morning. And we're mending this fence. And as the day went on, it was getting hotter and hotter. And by sort of early afternoon, I mean, we were stripped down to sort of T-shirts. And I've never seen so many midges. It was like being in Scotland. I'm absolutely eaten alive. My head feels like it's crawling. I've either got a bad dose of nits or it's the bites from the midges. I've got lumps everywhere.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, fun and games. And I ache everywhere from mending this blooming fence. So, yeah, that was one day in Wiltshire. But more relevantly, as people on the Facebook group will have seen, Stu, my regular walking buddy, and I went up to Tidcombe, up near Shoot Causeway, on Monday, to do a bit of a recce, because we're going to do, we're hoping to do another walk with Wiltshire Museum in that part of the world. So we've been talking to David Dawson, who comes with us on those walks. David's the director of Wiltshire Museum, who we'll be hearing from shortly. So I went to do a recce and really sort of looking at parking, because when we do these walks, we get anything up to about, I don't know, what's the maximum numbers, Glyn? About 12, something like that.
About 12, sometimes a few more.
Yeah. So out that part of the world, which is absolutely stunning, it's a beautiful place, parking is always going to be a bit of a challenge. So Stu and I went up to Tidcombe, a little, well, it's barely a village, it's a hamlet, I suppose, parked up there, and had a sort of mooch around for a few hours. And anybody who's seen the Facebook posts will see we had some incredible weather, you know, sort of rain squalls sweeping through, black clouds, rainbows. I mean, we just had everything. It was just astonishing light. But it's a really fascinating part of the world. You know, Neolithic long barrows, earthworks, beautiful views. You know, off in the distance, we could see Martinsell Hill and the windmill at Wilton, and then over to sort of to the northeast, all the way over to towards Hungerford. I mean, it's fantastic. That's going to be a great walk if we can pull that together and agree with David the sort of places that he wants to sort of take in along the route. I think you could easily do two or three walks up there. There's so much to see and do.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of history there. You've got the Shoot Causeway, which is the Roman road. You've got Iron Age Hill Fort. You've got Sarsen stones, mysterious Sarsen stones.
Yeah,
in the landscape, there's plenty to see and do, and it's a place that no one normally goes. No, that's why there's no parking.
That's right. It's
a pretty coast
there. And of course, something we're going to talk about in a bit with David is the view that Eric Villiers painted of Hip and Scoom and down there, which is another good reason to go.
And that's in the exhibition at the moment at Wiltshire Museum, which we will talk about in the next section. So shall we move on and introduce our guest after the music?
Yep.
So in this week's podcast, we are doing a special on Wiltshire Museum. And as part of that, we have a guest on, which is always a rare treat for myself and Paul. We've got David Dawson, who's the director of Wiltshire Museum. So David, welcome to the Hidden Wiltshire podcast.
Well, thanks very much for the invitation. I'm looking forward to this. Should be fun.
Yeah, yeah. I think you do listen to it, don't you, occasionally?
On occasion, yeah. No, I have to say, I have actually listened, I think, to each episode. So, you have a loyal listener who has more, because I love listening to your podcast while I'm sort of walking on, doing my usual walk up onto Roundway Down. So, it's great.
Yeah.
So that's 22 episodes you've put yourself through so far.
It's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I probably won't listen to this one, though.
No.
Yeah. Well, we must be doing something right if we've got someone that does come back and listen to them. And actually, the listening stats are quite good. So we'll go into those. Maybe on the one-year anniversary, Paul, we'll do a breakdown of who listens. Because you might be surprised at how many overseas listeners we have on this, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, so David, do you want to just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Oh, right. God. I'm an archaeologist. I have to declare that. I'm a sad archaeologist. I got bitten at the sort of the age of sort of 8 or 9 by two things. One was the Tutankhamun exhibition at the British Museum. So I dutifully queued up along with thousands of other people to go and see that. And also at my school, we were lent a Bronze Age axe. And so being able to hold something in my hand that was 4,000 years old, you know, it was just mind-boggling. And so it started from there, really. I went on an excavation at the age of 14. There was an excavation in the local town where I was staying on holiday. And I was able to, they said I could go there for a day. 2 weeks later, I was still there, so I probably didn't mess up too much. And then I was digging each summer, took a year out between school before going to university to do archaeology, spent that time mostly working on sites. And there you are. I then went to work for museums in Sussex, in Canterbury, went to museum training school to be trained to be a curator in Leicester. And then went to Oxfordshire, did something slightly different. I worked for an organization helping museums document their collections and use computers. I ended up in a national organization. But I'd always had my eye on this place because when I was doing archaeology at university, we came on a field trip to see Wessex, sort of Wessex archaeology, and we visited Avebury and Stonehenge, and we went down to Dorchester, but we came to the museum here in Devizes, the Wiltshire Museum, and I was just blown away by the collection, and I love the idea of a place that clearly was steeped in research and sort of the history of archaeology. And so at that point I thought, yeah, I could cope with that. So when the job came up 12, 13 years ago, it was a no-brainer.
So, David, did you have an interest in a particular sort of subject area or a particular era that drew you to this area, part of the world?
Yes and no. I was always, you know, everyone's fascinated by, you know, the various piles of rock. But at the same time, I knew I wasn't a great excavator. You know, I wasn't going to be, you know, one of these people who led major field projects, because I just wasn't good enough. But I enjoyed talking to people, I enjoyed chatting, and I enjoy sort of engage, you know, telling people about the past. And so it was natural then to say, well, you know, I don't have the brain power to be a researcher, you know, to do a PhD. So museums was a very obvious way to go. I did some voluntary work in the local university museum, and, you know, they went from there, really. So and if you're in a museum, you can't be a specialist. You have to know a little bit about everything, which also means you can say with great bravado, I wish I knew more about that, but it's not my period. Which is always a get-out clause, but yeah. I've always been obsessed by the Bronze Age, and interesting that the Saxons, so the Romans, I find a bit dull. But so those are the periods I'm most interested in. But you have to know something about everything.
Because for the you know, anybody who listens to the podcast or follows the Facebook groups. I mean, we've done a number of walks with you and sort of Wiltshire Museum, and it always amazes me how much you know about, you know, everything from Neolithic to Bronze Age, Iron Age, right through to the Romans. Yeah. Well, or you know that little bit more than the rest of us, which
you've spotted that.
Yes,
you know, the secret is always being just one step ahead.
That's right.
Like and also knowing where to find the information.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but I think one of the good things on those walks that we did is that. If we were going on a walk that had some relevance to what was in the museum archive, you'd bring along what we used to call your box of tricks. You get this box out of some pottery or some flints or something that had been found along the way, which brought it to life a bit more, I think.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful to be able to do that, to sort of bring objects found in the landscape back to where they come from.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful. I really enjoy doing that.
Yeah. So just going back to the museum, I mean, I'm a member of the museum or the society which is behind the museum. So could we say a bit about that? Because there's quite some history to it, isn't it? It's been around for quite some time.
Yeah. The museum's run by the I always need a run up for this, the Wiltshire Archaeological and Natural History Society, which was founded in 1853. So we've been around for a while. Initially, that was put together around a collection of books and papers, but before long, they started collecting objects as well. And in 1872, they bought their first building. They'd had a number of exhibitions in the town hall, for example, one or two other places for short periods, but there was no museum. So 1872, they bought what had been a Georgian schoolroom in Devizes, and they commissioned the building of a new entrance, and then that was the first museum, which opened in 1874.
And is that on the site of the current?
Yeah, the current
site.
That's where we are.
Oh, it's been there ever since?
Well, our current our lecture room was a schoolroom. It was built as the grammar school in 1830, but with the sort of increase in population and primary schooling being brought in 1870, they completely outgrew it. So it was there for us to buy as the heart of the museum. Then we've taken on two Georgian townhouses each side of that, and then I'm looking now at the rather stark 1980s gallery, art gallery, stuck on the side. So we've five buildings knocked into one.
And the society owns the site, the location.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So how is that? I mean, how do you get the funds to do all this?
You're looking hard at my grey hair, aren't you?
Well, yeah. I'm looking at Glyn. If he's a member, I assume it's coming out of his pocket.
Well, I mean, the members obviously contribute financially.
Oh, absolutely.
To be a member.
Yeah. I read with amusement a report produced by the Museums Association, which looked at local government funding of museums. The average funding per head for museums across the country is either £5 or £6 per person. In Wiltshire, it's about the Wiltshire Council spending is about a penny.
God. Really?
So we get a grant of £12,780 from Wiltshire Council and £4,000 from our town council. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm very grateful for that because local councils have to balance museums with children in care or looking after the older people. You know, there's huge pressures on their budgets, but you can't run a museum on £16,000. So we've very fortunate in having over 1,000 members. So thank you, Glyn. We charge for entry. We can't be free, which is an interesting topic of discussion. And we also rely very much on the generosity of past members. So we've had legacies over the years. So we have almost £1.5 million in investments. And it's that investment income that really is underpinning the organization. So when I came, we had, I think about £500,000-£600,000 in the bank in investments, and now we've got 1.5 million. And that's solely to down to almost solely down to the generosity of past members.
Because in talking to you on various walks, I know you've got quite considerable experience in applying for funding, and
yeah.
I guess it's a skill that you've sort of developed out of necessity over the years. So you're sort of developing proposals and submitting funding requests. But where do they go to? Who are you? Apart from the areas you've just sort of mentioned, I mean,
well, one that's really important for us is the Arts Council. We have joined with other museums to create the Wessex Museums Partnership, which is now an independent charitable trust, and that's with Salisbury, Poole, and Dorset Museums. And together we have developed a programme which the Arts Council are funding to the tune of £1.4 million over 4 years. So we're in the middle of delivering that programme. But it's very much a joint enterprise, and it's around trying to serve the communities in which each of those museums is based. And Glyn could probably say a little about that because he's one of the, well, he's the currently the joint chair of that trust.
Yes, indeed.
and so that is really important for us. We're not getting £1 million ourselves, but we're getting some support, which is absolutely vital. So, for example, an exhibitions officer and someone who's working very much with our local communities. And those are things we can't afford to do ourselves, because going back to the boring money, it's just, sorry about this, but it costs £350,000 a year to run the place, and generally our income is around £250,000. The result, as Mr. McCorber would say, is misery. Except because of the generosity of past members and increase in value of the investments in the stock market, in each year for the last 12 years, apart from one, we've ended up with more money in investments than we started with. So it's more by luck than judgment. It's, you know, it's a business model that shouldn't work, but does.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because I know that the charging aspect can be a bit emotional for some people, because mm-hmm. you go to other areas, like, you know, the British Museum, for instance, doesn't charge for entrance.
That's right.
Somewhere in more locally, Trowbridge Museum doesn't charge mm-hmm. for entrance, but I live in Trowbridge, and my council tax is paying towards that because the town council funds the museum.
And
you don't have that luxury, unfortunately.
No, and we each pay, all of us pays £6 in our taxes for the national museums.
Yeah.
I know it's really quite difficult for people to get their heads around, because the British Museum's free, for example, as you say, Chip and Trowbridge Museums, because their town councils have decided to invest in that way for their local community. But that's the way it works. But people are used to the idea of libraries being free, but they don't think twice about paying for a seat in the local theatre that's also run by the council, or paying to go and use the leisure centre, which is also run by the local council. So yeah, it's very difficult. I wish we could be free. What we have done is we only charge for adults. So children are always free. So that struck me as the best way to be able to make access as wide as possible all the time. And then we do have occasional free days as well, particularly for Heritage Open Day. And also we've had lots of support from the Heritage Lottery Fund, so the National Lottery Heritage Fund. So they have a day each year when they encourage places to open their doors, so we take part in that as well.
So when you talked about the sort of partner museums, do you apart from sort of the funding and that side of it, do you share resources in terms of sort of personnel? Is there somebody in Poole who's got a sort of certain skill that you can make use of in devices? Do you swap sort of personnel like that?
We're very keen on recycling.
Right.
So we learn from each other's mistakes and successes, you know, which is great, because we've got, you know, there's always someone, whatever issue, you know, is coming up, there's always someone that's done it. And so we can learn from what they've done. So that sort of sharing of experience is brilliant. Mm. And yes, we do have some shared posts. So we've got a small central team that do things for us. But also, for example, our community curator is a shared post with Salisbury Museum. So they're working for both museums because they're working across the whole of Wiltshire. So, you know, it stops them bumping into each other if there were two. You know, in an ideal world, we'd have two posts, but we've got a shared post.
Sure.
And that maximizes the joint working. And, you know, a key thing is that you may be familiar with this saying, better together. If people will visit one museum, they're very likely to visit another. And so it's about sharing audiences and building audiences together.
And I think it's worth saying as well, if you are a member of Wiltshire Museum, you get free entrance to the other partner museums.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Stonehenge as well.
And Stonehenge, yeah. So all these benefits, because we, just like Salisbury Museum, and we have nationally important collections. We have a special badge from the government that says that. So when I stand up and say, we're nationally important, it's not just me being big-headed. You know, we actually have an award from government that says that. We're one of 60 museums across England that have that status.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, and perhaps we'll come on to that in a bit. But just on this sort of theme of sharing and the resources, does that include exhibits? Do you have a collection that you'll share with Salisbury or wherever?
Yeah, at least two answers to that. One is we are in the process of building a shared virtual collection. So that, which will be coming up in the next year or two. But in a very practical level, yes, we've been sharing exhibitions. There was one created by an artist called Alchemy that has been to all four venues. And coming up next year is a special exhibition about Thomas Hardy, which will be a single exhibition, but in all four venues at the same time, in all four museums at the same time. So if you want to find about Thomas Hardy, you have to go on a pilgrimage around Wiltshire and Dorset. And each museum will pick up a different book and a particular theme. So ours is, you got me there, my brain's just gone blank for a moment. Ours is, our book is Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and our theme is antiquarians, because of course Tess is arrested at Stonehenge. And we have collections that relate to the Stonehenge and Avebury World Heritage Site. So that's our focus. In Salisbury, their book is Jude the Obscure. And Jude actually is recorded as going to the building that is now the museum. So the museum is featured, the building that's now the museum is featured in the book. And their topic is urban life in towns. And that's the same for Poole and Dorset, you know. So we pick up different themes. So that's going to be absolutely fantastic. And I hesitate to say this has never been done before, because I'm sure it has somewhere, but none of us could think of where it has been done before. So it's certainly unusual.
I think you've definitely chosen, well, you've been given one of the best books there with Tess of the D'Urbervilles and Stonehenge Collection. Because I have to say, Jude the Obscure and Salisbury. Jude the Obscure is probably the most depressing book I think I've ever read.
Absolutely.
I think it was made into a film with Christopher Eccleston in as well. Yeah, and it's not
that Tess is a barrel of laughs either, no, but no. It's nothing by comparison to Jude.
Yeah, exactly. And as well, I know that Hardy, I know he hasn't written that much about Wiltshire, but obviously he includes Salisbury as one of his towns.
Melchester.
And we know he's written about the Devil's Den as well, which is a particular favourite of this podcast.
Of course.
The location, anyway. But I think when we did the Devil's Den podcast, I actually read it out, Hardy passage.
And I think so in the last podcast about the Great Ridge, I think there's a sort of Hardy reference there. I can't remember what it was now, but
that was Snail Creek Hangar.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Wonderful name that was.
Yeah. Fantastic. I'd love to know where some of these names come from. But just going on to what you've actually got in the museum, I mean, you've got some fairly impressive stuff in terms of the collection itself. I mean, the Bronze Age gold, which I've seen, is outstanding. And the way the museum's set up, you can get very close to it and see it with your own eyes. It's fascinating stuff.
What do I say? Yes. the standout objects are those. Well, what's interesting about our collection is that a lot of it comes from an archaeologist called William Cunnington, who basically invented archaeology 200 years ago, and he excavated 200 barrows across the Stonehenge landscape, or across the Wiltshire landscape, largely around Stonehenge. And we have the finds from his excavations. And he was working a really interesting time, because it was before steam ploughing was brought in. And in the Victorian period, you see these accounts of barrows being destroyed by the steam plough. He excavated them before that, so he essentially rescued them. One of the reasons the Stonehenge landscape is so well preserved is he excavated these barrows, and they and sort of the finds from them highlighted their importance, so they were preserved. The most impressive finds, though, are from a barrow from a place called Bush Barrow, which is in sight of Stonehenge. It's sitting on the top of the Normanton Down Ridge, looking down over the monument. It's about a kilometre away. And, you know, it's Stonehenge is fascinating, because people, all the TV programmes and things, only ever talk about the stones. Now, the lifespan of Stonehenge is really interesting, because there's some stuff around in the Mesolithic period, 8,000 BC, some timber posts. The blue stones from Wales arrive at 3,000 BC. The big Sarsen stones, that's the big uprights with flat lintels, 2,500 BC. But it's then in use for another 1,000 years before it's abandoned. And when you take that timescale and go back, that means from today that the Sarsens went up at the time of the Norman conquest. And go back to when the blue stones arrived, that's sort of the end of when the Romans left, or when the Saxons arrived, that sort of timescale, which is quite mind-boggling. And the Bush Barrow burial dates from around 1950 BC. So in those terms, it's sort of around the time of Queen Elizabeth or Henry VIII, probably. Actually, that's a really good example, Henry VIII, because Cunnington, when he excavated, and I use the word quite loosely, he said that the skeleton was of a stout and tall man. And all we know about the skeleton is that from the length of the femur, we know that he was 5'11" or 6 foot. So, you know, he was big for the period. You know, most people would have been a couple of inches shorter than they are today, the average today. And he was buried with the most amazing gold work. So on his chest, he had a gold, what we called lozenge, sort of diamond-shaped thing, which is made of very thin sheet gold wrapped over what would have been a wooden backing. And that's decorated with embossed lines and zigzags. The shape of that is really interesting, because it's the angle at the top and the bottom is 81 degrees. And that's the same angle as between where the sun rises at the midwinter and the midsummer solstices. So there's an astronomical link there. And the decoration, particularly some of the finer zigzag decoration, is laid out to a tolerance of less than half a millimeter. Now, what that all means is that the people in the Bronze Age, 4,000 years ago, knew about mathematics. They could measure, they could count, they could multiply. They knew about geometry, they could measure angles. They knew about astronomy. And yet, you know, when you talk about prehistory and you think of people like Fred Flintstone, which is on my mug, by the way, you know, bashing people over the head and not having a clue. No, these were really sophisticated people.
Yeah, I think we've sort of discussed this in some of the walks, haven't we, that these people were, you know, they were every bit as intelligent as we are. It's just that they hadn't, you know, the technology available to them hadn't developed.
They were developing it.
Absolutely. And we're still developing it. And in, you know, 3,000 years' time, if we're still here, then people will look back at us in the same way as we look at back at them.
Yeah. And the key thing is they left no records that we can go back to.
Hence prehistory.
Yeah.
Do we know who this man was who was buried at Bush Barrow?
No.
because it's well, because actually, there's no history.
We could say quite a lot about him because he clearly was, you know, in the sense of the skeleton is still in the barrow, so we can't do all the, you know, the fancy DNA analysis and isotope analysis and so on, which would be fascinating to know. But we can work out quite a lot about him because he was obviously important. You know, he's buried with this gold lozenge. He's got an amazing gold dagger, which perhaps we can talk about in a moment. But these things were made by craftspeople. And he and the other people buried on that same ridge, the objects they're buried with have got stuff from all across Europe. Amber, which originates from the Baltic. So they were in contact with people out in Denmark. The dagger I need to talk about, I must tell you about that, may well have come from Brittany, but there are examples like it, if you like, copies in Greece. So, you know, there are connections right the way across Europe, but the quality of craftsmanship here is above that anywhere else in Europe at the time. So this guy was the top dog. You know, in the past he was called king, but that implies all sorts of political relationships which we can't be sure about. So we call him a chieftain. But he was clearly in charge at Stonehenge. He's buried with a dagger and an axe. There are axes and daggers carved on the stones. You know, he was the boss. There is absolutely no doubt. But when you look at the quality of the craftsmanship, you know, you've then got, so he's the boss. He's got to have underlings to make everything work because he's just going to sit around all day, isn't he? Just like the rest of us. Yeah. He's got to have other underlings who organize things. Then you've got to have craftspeople who make this stuff. And because of the quality, you know, these people have been, they've had apprenticeships. There's hundreds of years of experience gone into the understanding of how to make these things. And then somebody somewhere has to go and grow the food, look after the sheep, build the house, weave the cloth. So it tells you immediately there's a highly organized society here.
Actually, it's interesting what you say there about these craftsmen. I mean, when we were talking to Andrew Zeminski on the podcast, you know, he was talking about the stonemasons at Stonehenge and some of the joints on those lintels and, you know, why they made them the way that they made them. I mean, basically he said they didn't need to go to the lengths that they went to make the stones fit together because, you know, the lintels are so blimmin' heavy that they're not going to fall off, but they still had these incredible joints. You know, the skill involved in doing that is I mean, I'm not sure, you know, that Andrew and his team could do that now, or they could.
I'm sure Andrew could.
but it would take them with power tools, because his point was that, you know, they're using power tools because sarsen stone is so so hard, and to do it with the tools that they had, I mean, he's just in awe of the skills of those guys. He made the point that these were probably a team of sort of travelling stonemasons who went around the local area and they worked on Stonehenge and they worked somewhere else. But we mentioned this before. Why aren't there more Stonehenges? Because they probably all died of lung disease because of the
so silica dust.
Silica dust. Yes, yeah. Thank you. Yes. But, you know, maybe it was the same with, you know, when it came to making sort of, you know, the lozenge or the dagger and, you know, these are, would those people have, you know, like you do at the museum, were they sharing people with great skills?
Yeah, I like the idea of a team, except there's nothing anywhere quite like it anywhere else. So,
no.
But at the same time, Stonehenge are built with woodworking techniques.
Mm.
Yeah, exactly.
So what they've done is they've used stone woodworking techniques and then built something in stone instead.
Mm.
So that's where the sort of heritage of that comes from.
Yeah.
But, it's very clear that there can only have been a few of these real craftspeople knocking this stuff out. And I've got to tell you about the dagger. Because,
tell us about the dagger, David.
Which is, the dagger itself is, well, an old money, about eight, the blade is 8-9 inches long, made of bronze. But the amazing bit is the wooden handle, which is set with gold studs. They make a zigzag pattern. The heads of them make a zigzag pattern. And you might think that they look a bit like nails, these studs, but they're not. They're not hammered in. What they did was they took, they got the wood of the handle. There's a thin layer of pine gum, and they took a sharp bronze point. You can see I'm doing this with my hands because it means I remember how it works. And they took a sharp bronze point, make a hole through into the wood, and then take a single gold stud and put it into the hole they've made, and then another hole and another stud. And they're making lines with the heads of these studs and zigzag patterns. And that all sounds fine until I tell you that the studs are the thicknesses of a human hair, and most of them are less than a millimeter long. And this dagger handle is made of 140,000 of them to do the decoration.
Wow.
And there were no magnifying glasses. So that was done with the naked eye. And it's been suggested it was done by children.
By children, yeah.
Because kids, you know, age between, what, sort of 8 and 14 have got, you know, nimble fingers and great eyesight.
Mm.
Your eyesight starts deteriorating once you hit 18. Although for some of us, it was rather before that. But it's been suggested that if kids were doing that, if they were doing it for any length of time, it would have ruined their eyesight.
And is that
so
dagger,
they were disabling themselves.
And that dagger is in your museum, is it?
Yeah, well, what's left of it. Yeah.
Well, how much is there left of it?
There's... well, probably about 3%. But we've got a wonderful watercolour done by an artist at the time, a chap called Philip Crocker, who was working with William Cunnington. And he's done this picture of it with the zigzag lines. And it shows it as it came out the ground.
And so has it deteriorated since they pulled it out of the barrow?
Yeah. He shows the wood of the handle in place, but... You know, having been hoiked out the ground 200 years ago, there's no conservation, no idea of how to look after these things, and it clearly fell apart within a few days.
It's fascinating to bring Cunnington to life, really, because we talk about him a lot on the podcast. He regularly crops up, but to you know, hear an example in detail of what he got up to. What was the relationship between, or the connection between him and Hoare?
William Cunnington was he was really interesting because he was a wool merchant. He'd been to grammar school in Warminster. That's quite important because that meant he was educated, and he obviously done Latin because, you know, that was what education was at the time. But he hadn't gone to university. So he wasn't, you know, a cleric. And so he hadn't quite had everything rammed down his throat. So he was quite able to think out of the box. I think he was quite independent. He was also trade. He wasn't gentry. So he had, you know, he didn't have quite the same axes to grind or the same status to uphold. And his doctor told him, well, in his sort of later middle years, he got gout, and his doctor told him to get some exercise. So as Joe Wicks wasn't around, he was told to ride out. And what that meant was to go fox hunting. But he wasn't gentry, so that probably wasn't open to him. Instead, he was obviously fascinated by the landscape he lived in. He lived in Heytesbury. And so he decided to, sort of archaeology, what we now call archaeology, was just sort of coming to the fore. William Stukeley had published his book about Avebury and Stonehenge. People had started digging holes in things. And so that's what he decided to do. He had enough money to employ two farm labourers, Stephen and John Parker, to dig in some barrows. And at the time, Sir Richard Colt Hoare had just acquired the rather small family farm, and they obviously met through their shared interest in what we now call archaeology. So the Hoare family, there's still a bank in London, Hoare's Bank, where you have to have a liquid assets, in other words, cash, or something like 10 million quid before they have a bank account.
Yes.
And his small family farm, family-owned farm, is rather better known as Stourhead with 3,600 acres. So the way it worked was that Sir Richard would sit in his study and receive regular reports from Cunnington. And he edited those reports together to publish Ancient Wiltshire, which is the first real county archaeology. And essentially, Cunnington ran out of money, but that was something Colt Hall wasn't short of. So they essentially teamed up. Sir Richard would occasionally go and visit, but would really just sit in the library and wait for the reports and see the objects that came out of the excavations.
Amazing.
But Colt Hall was in contact with the Lunar Society, so that's the sort of the group in, particularly in Birmingham, who were pushing forward with the sort of scientific advances step by step with the emerging industrial revolution. So there was a lot of influential thought going on about the big questions of how long people have been around, when was the world created, geology. You know, all of these things were in their infancy. They didn't use the word archaeology. There was no understanding of what we call the three-age system of stone, bronze, and iron ages. It's fascinating because in some of the bits that Colt Hall didn't include in Ancient Wiltshire, you can see Cunnington writing down. You can see that he got that progression, the stone, bronze, iron, but didn't write it down, and it wasn't published. It wasn't published till 1830, which was 20 years after Cunnington died. But it's, you know, I think he got there.
So, just conscious of your time as well. What other sort of really important collections, or in what you consider to be important, do you have at Devizes?
Well, if we move on slightly to the Saxon period, so there's a couple of things. One is there's an amazing cemetery at just outside Pusey called Blacknor Field, where almost the whole cemetery has been excavated. And that's really interesting because then at the centre there are burials of a really important man and woman. And they're clearly essentially the founding generation for that Saxon community. And then later burials and so on. So that's and you can see the way that as children grew up, people grew up, they were given different things to take with them into the grave by those they left behind. So young girls had an iron neck ring, but that's only up to the age of 2 or 3. Then when they hit 12, presumably puberty, they start getting some beads. And then when they become slightly older, mid-20s or thereabouts, they have more brooches, and they have particularly keys, which shows that they're in charge of the household. So you can see that progression in life. And for boys and men, generally boys don't have anything until they hit sort of 13, 14, then they get a spear. And if they're really fortunate, they get particularly by the time they hit their 20s, they have a sword. So it's really interesting to be able to trace that progression. And you can sort of map out the community because nearly the whole cemetery has been excavated, which is unusual. But the standout burial is one on Roundway Down. So just up by Oliver's Castle. It's been ploughed flat now, but there was a Bronze Age barrow that had had a Saxon burial put in it later. And this is a burial of a woman, and she has a fabulous necklace of gold set with different stones, including garnets from the Indian subcontinent. She has two gold pins linked by a gold chain with a central roundel that has a cross on it. And she's also buried with a tiny little coin, which is about 1/4 inch. So 3 millimeters in diameter, and that was struck by a bishop in central France. So you then have this really interesting picture of very rich burial on the top of Roundway Down. Why? Yeah. And the answer is probably that at Bromham, we know in the later Saxon period, that is a royal manor. So it belongs to the king. And because the trees at Ranway Down, you don't appreciate that if you where that barrow is, if you look down into the valley, you're looking down at Bromham. And if you're in Bromham, you'd be looking up and you'd see that barrow silhouetted on the skyline. And the cross and that coin struck by a bishop implies she's Christian. And at the time, many members, female members of a royal family would be abbesses. And, or if, particularly if they're, you know, if they were queen and their husband died, then they would go to a nunnery. That would be their retirement. So it's presumably is a royal burial, and it could be either the wife or the daughter of King Aine, who really sort of pushed the Saxons, really took over our part of Wessex.
So
she's buried on a bed, which again is highly unusual. There's about 20 bed burials.
Yeah.
And that puts her in the same status, sort of level of status as the burial at Sutton Hoo, for example. And at the each corner of the bed is a different animal. A fox, a goose, I think it's a cat and a dog or something like that. I can't quite remember. So the whole thing is just really weird. Mm.
So the finds from these burials at Pusey and Ranway Down, people can see these in the museum?
Oh, yeah.
So sort of bringing us up to the present, you've got a fantastic exhibition on at the moment, which I must come and see, the Revilius exhibition. Do you want to? I know that this has caused you some anxiety over the months, to say the least.
Understatement.
Yeah, go and tell us about it.
Well, so Eric Revilius is a really well-known 1930s artist, and he just captures the English landscape, particularly downland landscape of Sussex and Wiltshire. And he just painted these wonderful pictures. So many people will recognise the Westbury White Horse, or the his view of the Uffington White Horse, for example. Yeah. And he just captures the Downs beautifully. So I've only been slightly obsessed by him since 1984, when my wife dragged me to the Imperial War Museum, because I'm not really, you know, I'm not really into art particularly, and even more so, I'm not into war museums. So, and then he became a war artist. And so that's why the IWM, the Imperial War Museum, have this fantastic collection of his paintings. But this was the whole of his work, you know, sort of looking at all aspects of his work. And I was just blown away by his paintings. So that was 1984. And when I moved here, you know, I knew about the Westbury White Horse, and I knew he'd done a whole series of watercolours about Wiltshire, which I knew I'm pretty sure we'd never get. We didn't have one in the collection. But then one of my members rang me up and said, are you going for this Revilius sketchbook? To which my answer was, what Revilius sketchbook? He'd been commissioned to create what was going to be a puffin book for children. And he'd been given a notebook the same size, same number of pages, and told to do some sketches. And this came on the market in 2012. And it had a picture of looking at the Westbury White Horse through the windows of a train carriage on the front cover.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So I had 3 days, almost time team tradition. So we rather nervously bid at the auction, and we got it. So that then is sort of the centerpiece of the exhibition, and we've been able to bring together a whole series of works from national museums across the country and from our friends at Towner Gallery in Eastbourne to highlight, to really examine the way that he, his love for the Downs, his love for the chalk downlands of southern England.
Because somebody asked me this the other day, where he was from. Was he from Sussex?
Yeah, he was born in London, but his family moved to Sussex when he was very young. But he came to Wiltshire because he had a commission to do a mural at a college in East London. And he met the private secretary, in other words, the fixer for the then Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin. This was Sir Geoffrey Fry. His country pad was Orr House. here in Wiltshire.
Oh, yeah.
And Sir Geoffrey Fry was a great patron of the arts, invited him down, commissioned him to do some watercolours, and really gave a huge boost to his career. And so when he was commissioned to do a whole series of watercolours of Wiltshire, and that, and he loved the idea of the white horses, and because of course in Sussex he's got the Wilmington Longman, which was a leitmotif in his work throughout his life, and this commission to do the book. The book was provisionally titled White Horses, but was going to be called Downland Man.
So,
but he never lived to finish it.
So how many pieces have you got in the exhibition?
We've got 20 odd watercolours drawn from those national collections.
And back to the money side, what's the entry cost?
£6 for adults, oh. £5 for concessions.
Bargain.
And
bargain.
Children free.
Children free. And of course,
and the good thing is, if you come and see the Revealist exhibition, of course, you can also have a look at the other stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's for the entrance to the whole museum. And we've not racked the price up. But I have to say, there is rather a good catalogue available for £12.99, which has got everything in the exhibition is in the catalogue. It's brilliant. The exhibition was put together by a guest curator called James Russell, who's just been brilliant. It's absolutely wonderful insight into Eric and his life.
Mm. And hopefully his wonderful son, James, one of my favourite photographers.
Oh, yes.
Absolute genius of a photographer.
Absolutely.
Just perhaps to finish off, the future, because you're looking to move, aren't you? Not you personally, but the museum.
Personally moving, I go out of here in a box, I think. Those of you that know Devizes, there's the older Sizecourt building is on the road out to Chippenham and Trowbridge, which if you've not seen it, it just looks like a mini British Museum. There are four, what I now know, Ionic columns with a Greek pediment over the top. Built as the Assize Court in 1853, it's been derelict since 1983.
This is next to the brewery, isn't it?
Next to Wadsworth's Brewery. Yeah. So, and if we can raise the odd penny or two, want to bring it back to life as a community hub and the new home for the museum. Checks gratefully accepted, particularly if they're in the order of £12.7 million
ish. Yeah. What's the timescale? When you're hoping to?
Well, raising the money will take a minimum of 4 or 5 years, and then it'll take 4 or 5 years to do the whole thing. So probably sort of 8 to 10 years. Unfortunately, if I go when I'm supposed to, I'll have retired by then.
Right. But unless they can persuade you otherwise.
I may cling on.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll make you a trustee of something or other, won't they, to keep your expertise and skills in the game.
Well, you know, get rid of me as soon as they can, one of the two.
Yeah.
Deadwood, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, David. That's been a fascinating discussion, I think.
Brilliant.
A real pleasure. And thanks very much for the invitation. I've enjoyed it.
So many thanks to David Dawson for that recording of quite an interesting discussion, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. I mean, I don't know about you, but I felt that we could have gone on for a lot longer.
There was more to talk about, believe me.
Yeah.
Because actually, one thing I did, when you become a member of the society, one of the things you get as an introduction is you get a personal tour of the museum from David. So the new members are invited to this. It's usually on a Saturday morning. And you get taken into the parts of the museum that are off limits to the public normally. So down into the basement where they've got boxes of artifacts, and up into the library where they've got copies of the first edition of Stukeley's book on Avebury and things like that. It's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. So
actually, something I'd written in my notes to ask David about, and we just ran out of time because he had a meeting to go to, but was the map collection. I think they've got quite an impressive map collection, haven't they?
Oh, they do. Yeah. I mean, if you were interested in studying the history of Wiltshire and stuff like that, it's a fantastic place to go and spend some time. You can contact them and arrange to sit in the library and get access to, like you say, the map collection or various things that they've got in the archive that's in the building.
I remember, I mean, this is going back almost to the beginning of the podcast when we were talking about Imba, and I was talking about a chap who asked us to help him find a cottage on the Imba Range where he was he used to visit when he was a lad during the war.
Mm.
And I emailed Wiltshire Museum before I knew David and asked if they could help with old maps, and they couldn't have been more helpful, and they sort of invited me up there to spend a morning going through the old mm. maps, and so they were going to sort of have somebody to sort of take me through it all, and unfortunately lockdown got in the way and we never did it, but I'd love to see that. And of course the exhibition, the Revilius exhibition, absolute must. I mean, that's a really unique opportunity to see, you know, so many of his works in one place, and for £6, I mean, that's an absolute bargain.
Yeah, it is. And joining the society, and it's quite reasonable as well. One of the things you get for your money, I mean, we pay about, I don't know, £4 something a month. You can pay monthly. But one of the things you get is the annual archaeology publication the museum pulls out, which is a really good book, actually, of the, you know, research over the last 12 months, archaeological stuff which has been done in the county. And my son, who's got a degree in archaeology, looked at it and said it's a really high quality book.
Mm.
You know, with proper referencing, and it almost looks like an academic. Well, almost, it looks like an academic book.
Yeah.
In terms of quality of references and research, so you get that as part of your membership as well. So yeah. Really good value.
Superb.
So I guess we've got to wrap up.
Yeah.
Another week.
Yeah. This was I'm sure we mentioned it before. This was number 23.
I'm glad you're keeping
episode 20. Yeah. Well, I have to keep a list of the music that we use, because Steve's music, and I'm running out of material. So Steve, if you ever listen to this, we need more, mate. We need more music. that piece that we used before speaking to David, I picked that for no other reason than we hadn't used it before. It's actually called Porto, and I just have this vision of my head of Steve sitting there playing the accordion in that piece. Of course, it's all computer generated, and I'm sure he hasn't got an accordion, but I just liked that image in my head.
It's funny, because I actually went to a concert for the first time since lockdown, a real music concert at the Pound Arts Centre in Corsham last weekend, and it was a folk band called India Electric Home, and one of the guys there was playing the accordion, and it was actually really nice to hear, you know, a real accordion being played in front of your eyes.
I think it's an acquired taste. You get the kind of the classic sort of French sound of the accordion, which I hate, which is awful, as is all French music. But there's like the English folk version. It's probably not an accordion. It's probably called something else. But I love that sound.
Yeah,
I'm going to go and see a band on Sunday. I'm going to see a sort of folk kind of jazz band called This Is the Kit. So they're going back to their roots, and they're performing in the back room of the Railway Inn in Winchester, which is where it all started for them years ago. But looking forward to that. Other credits, other mentions, the offer from Lower Boots. I think I'm going to talk to Tim Kington about that, because I don't know how he feels about it, and I don't know how many he's sold on the back of the discount code, but it probably needs to be drawn to a close at some point. So I'll have a chat with him, and you know, I don't know about you, but it feels like the end of the year seems about right. Run it for a year, but go on to, if you want a pair of walking boots or shoes, lower.co.uk, discount code at checkout, HW for Hidden Wiltshire, 20 for 20% discount. Thanks to Steve Dixon. We've done that. Go to the Hidden Wiltshire website for show notes, and of course the online shop, where you will find the book in
due course,
in the fullness of time. Yes.
We'll put pre-orders up on that before it comes out, but the idea is that we'll get it out to people before Christmas. If it'll be a nice Christmas gift, I would expect, for a lot of people. More on that in due course. But yeah, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and we will be back in 2 weeks' time to talk about I don't know what at the moment.
No, no idea.
Something about Hidden Wiltshire. Bye for now.
Ta-da.